This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We shall talk about the Indian filmmaker Ritvik Ghatak, 1925 to 76, and his film Shubarnarekha, The Golden Line, which was made in 1962. Ghatak managed to make only 8 feature films and a few documentaries in a life troubled by box office failures, alcoholism, and illness. Largely ignored in his lifetime by critics, his reputation has grown since the 1980s. His films are being shown internationally. Scholarly work on them is building up. A retrospective was held at the Lincoln Center in November. A major focus of this literature is the way Ghatak cinema has responded to the event of the partition of India / Bengal in 1947. In fact, Shubarnarekha, Golden Line, is considered the third part of a trilogy on partition. The other two being Meghe Dhaka Tara, Cloud Capped Star, 1960, and Komal Gandhar, Kandhar Sublime, 1961. It is indeed difficult to think of his films without reference to the partition. As an artist of the left, emerging out of the Indian radical arts movement of the 1940s, Ghatak felt compelled to react to the experience of uprooting and suffering caused by the partition. But he did so in a unique way. He chose to extend the theme of uprooting to that of a universal predicament of homelessness and to treat it as a source of all-round misery. This did not find favor with critics, who felt he was obsessing over a single event rather than look at larger historical processes or political questions. However, a close look at his films reveals the obsession to be not so much with the event itself as with the traces in which it lived on. With lives fatefully altered, individuals trapped in circumstances beyond their control, communities in slow disintegration. Ghatak was not interested in a sociological investigation of partition, but in turning it into an event that could grow in aesthetic contemplation, take on mythical proportions even. To speak of obsession, only 3 of the 8 feature films that he made, only 3 of them, Bari Theke Paliye, The Runaway, 1959, Gandhar Sublime, 61, and this one, Shubarnarekha, directly refer to the partition. Meghe Dhaka Tara, Cloud Capped Star, is set in a refugee neighborhood, colony, as they are called in West Bengal, but does not mention partition. And the other 4 films do not at all. An interesting principle of representation emerges from this fact. Partition is in the people. It is an event in that flowing sense, not a happening to be captured. Ghatak attended to the evidence of life lived in the wake of something that divided the people, barred them from relating to their world the way they had for ages, for generations. In the new homes, they could not see the same sky. As a character in his play, Ghatak was also a dramatist and a theater person, in fact, had a lifelong association with theater, much longer than cinema. As a character in his play, the Dolil, which translates as document, written in 1952, says, this character says, even the sky is different here, a refugee character. The same dialogue, incidentally, is repeated in a play within Gandhar Sublime. Exactly the same snatch of dialogue. He said in an essay on Gandhar Sublime that his intention was to point to the, and I quote, the homeless dimension of life. His contemporaries were puzzled to find him attributing all the decay and crisis of the post-independence decades to one fundamental misfortune, as it did in his essays and interviews. Indeed, it was only he who was speaking in those terms. His contemporaries, the socially critical voices, were looking for economic and political explanation of the deepening crises of the independent nation. Why would Ghatak choose to have such a vision of history? If it was an enigma to his critics, it remains one to make sense of. The available modes of rationalist explanation must have appeared inadequate to him for understanding what he saw as a pervasive crisis of Bengali slash Indian life. The new nation seemed to fail on basic questions of social justice. For Ghatak, something more happened. Collectives disintegrated, individuals lost a sense of belonging, bonds were broken, the world had become unfamiliar. This dimension of the story called for an epic approach, he thought, not realist narration. To bring into a single configuration of loss, a unified expression of separation, all that was happening, to create life affirmative gestures in the face of annihilation, the director had to raise the partition to an originary mythical status. This compulsion to push the historical to the universal made Ghatak abandon the relatively more realist style of his earlier film, Ajantrik, the second film actually, The Unmechanical, made in 1958. Abandon that style, the relatively more realist style, and adopt a form that incorporated operatic elements, allegorized characters, fateful turns of the plot, dramatic saturation of emotions. Serious filmmaking in India had been developing along a realist path inspired by the Italian neorealism and had only recently earned international acclaim for it. Ghatak was part of this new cinema of the 1950s. Therefore, his choice of form after Ajantrik, this new form, was as puzzling as his understanding of the contemporary predicament. The melodramatic elements employed in his films between 1959 and 62 were often trivialized in their use in Indian popular cinema. It is usually argued on Ghatak's behalf that he used melodrama to critically overturn it, to do something else. A recent example of this approach is the article on Ghatak published in New York Review of Books, I think only last week. But this seems to be a partial understanding of his method. He did not really adopt the melodramatic form of popular cinema, only worked with elements of narration and performance shared by that cinema. For him, the source was the living traditions of epic narration, where discursive passages mix with performance and high drama, where characters are etched in bold outlines and choric supplements follow individual destiny. Moreover, he had a lifelong association with theater, from which he often drew inspiration. Given his admiration for Eisenstein and Brecht, this should not come as a surprise. To combine an emotionally saturated dramatic narration with philosophical reflection on forms of consciousness, one could summarize Ghatak's project in these terms. I would like to see this as a modernist moment in Indian cinema, if we are prepared to take modernism as something with multiple beginnings and as internally heterogeneous. Ghatak's critics thought that his melodramatic turn made room for excess. Rather than explaining away excess as a disguise for something else, as writers sometimes do in his defense, one should acknowledge its presence in relation to an unassimilated, unutterable content in his films. Melodrama is inadequate for the truly tragic dimensions of the plots of Cloud-Capped Star or The Golden Line, Subarnarekha. These films work on a substance that finally cuts through the surface of sentiment explodes as a primal scream. One remembers Nita's last cry in Meghadakatara, Cloud-Capped Star, or the howling of Ishwar in Golden Line after his sister kills herself. The way they are treated as auditory and visual events signals a withdrawal from the unfolding story of ordinary lives, a passage through social existence into something primordial that envelops it. So far as these scenes are concerned, there is a connection between the tragic content and kinship, more specifically, brother and sister relationship in Ghatak. I have discussed this in some detail elsewhere, in fact, Rahul was referring to that essay. For our present purpose, let us consider the idea that rather than appearing as climaxes to the line of emotional development, these are ruptures in Ghatak cinema. They signify the point where the realization dawns that the suffering is too great to be contained within the tonal order of the story. These are the truly challenging dimensions of excess in Ghatak cinema, not the sentimental parts. However, this is not akin to what melodrama theorists used to call the hysteric dimension of melodrama. If you think of Geoffrey Noel Smith and others in the 1980s, it is not an instance of repressed individual emotions bursting out in hyperbolic expression. What the excess comes to stand for is the untold collective story, the story that cannot be told since every field of representation has its limits. The standard mode of representing historical events, popularized by Hollywood, proceeds on the assumption that an event is incidents plus character. And however profound its dimensions, it is measurable and therefore representable. Such films run on the premise that representation cannot contain absence or failure. The moment of narrative modernism popularized by the French cinema of the New Wave developed modes of responding to the traumatic memory of a world that had passed through the WW2. The method of ellipsis associated with the New Wave films should perhaps be seen in this light, a reconciliation of the promise of direct capture in cinema and the impossibility of capturing all. Alain René's method of displacing the event into faltering memory in Night and Fog and Hiroshima Mon Amour comes to mind as examples. In New German cinema or New Latin American cinema, ellipsis often dealt with the collective memory of unbearable historical experience. Ghatak can be seen engaged in such modernist practice in his own different way. Dramatic turn of events in Subarnarekha is punctuated with gaps. They're not exactly like the ellipsis in a René or a Godard film. But neither should they be treated as familiar devices indicating the passage of time. I will come back to this point later. They serve as a basis of a narration, these gaps in narration in Ghatak, that's a basis of a narration that is built upon lives violently interrupted. And they indicate the unrepresentable aspect of experience that haunt the collective. This is beyond individuals and never rationally assimilated in personal lives. But it haunts, derails, even destroys those lives. For Ghatak, one way of acknowledging the invisible experience was to recast it in mythical dimensions. He felt such experiences resonate with the deepest symbolic reserve of the collective, embodied in archetypal stories and images. Subarnarekha has a scene, Golden Line, has a scene where the female protagonist, Sita, as a young girl, suddenly confronts a Kali figure, a goddess Kali figure, in an abandoned airstrip, a relic from WW2. Ghatak writes in a Jungian vein, I quote from Ghatak, "All of a sudden, this fearsome figure of Kali appears before her. The shuddering girl seeks refuge in the embrace of a passerby. And then she learns that the Kali figure is an impersonating Bahurupi." It's a kind of somebody who kind of, you know, takes these disguises, who puts on disguises in order to earn his daily meal. He did not want to scare the little sister, as he calls her, just happened to come upon her. "I somehow feel," Ghatak writes, "I somehow feel that our whole civilization has stumbled upon that archetypal image of the terrible mother. The life and death of all civilization today hangs on that confrontation." This is from an essay that he wrote in 1963. As one records common lives in its aftermath, the event becomes a shadow. As a refugee colony as a setting, or characters referring to 1947, act as simple representation. But when the story moves away from the refugee environment, as it happens in Subarnarekha, as people find a way to escape that reality and find a life of relative comfort, how does the theme of uprooting and splintering lend itself to representation? It could be instructive to proceed with this question. Komal Gandhar, Gandhar Sublime, also has an underlying theme of escape from the crushing lower middle class existence. Anasuya, the female protagonist, has a fiancé in Europe. Towards the end, she almost leaves the city. We see shots of the road from a car leading to the airport. But in a magical reverse movement, not staged for us, she arrives at the suburban town where her comrades in radical theatre have come to perform. Komal Gandhar is a film on union, marriage, of theatre pitched against forces of separation. In Subarnarekha, the escape from the refugee colony spells disaster. The three central characters, Ishwar, Sita and Obhiram, leave the city to find their new home, as they call it. But they're forced to return and face the horror lying at the core of the city. There are gaps in this movement when things seem to happen but are not shown. Instead, we have signals of an impending encounter with the terrible that the director speaks of. A brief summary of the story is in order at this point for those of you who have not seen the film. Subarnarekha begins in a refugee colony. Ishwar, a leader of the refugees struggling for a foothold, adopts Obhiram, a young boy forcibly separated from his mother by the henchmen of landlords trying to evict them. Obhiram is the same age as Sita, Ishwar's own sister. Ishwar gets an offer from a rich college friend of a job in a village outside the border of Bengal. His departure is seen as a betrayal by his fellow refugees. His friend Haroprasad calls him a deserter. They make their new home in a mill area by the river Subarnarekha, hence the name of the film. Obhiram and Sita grow up and fall in love with each other. Obhiram also discovers that the mother he was taken away from is a Bagdi, belonging to the lowest rung in caste hierarchy. Ishwar is opposed to their marriage. He tries to marry Sita off to someone else. The two lovers elope. They end up in a slum in Calcutta. Obhiram takes up a bus driver's job and gets killed in an accident. Meanwhile, a lonely and devastated Ishwar tries to commit suicide. His refugee friend Haroprasad arrives before he can do so, he can commit suicide. The cynical and broken Haroprasad lures Ishwar to the city in search of what he calls grotesque fun. After a night of revelry, Ishwar ends up at the door of Sita, who by then has been reduced to prostitution. Sita slashes her own throat and dies a violent death. Ishwar claims to be her killer, but the court absolves him of that charge. He returns to the village with Sita's young son. The film ends on the last leg of their trek back to their home by the river, by the Subarnarekha River. As he turned to what he considered an epic form, Ghatak started weaving strands of discourse around a narrative line. Unlike the familiar reflexive cinema, these overlaying threads are not playful or ironic. They are made of allusions and citations that create a horizon of echoes so that words and action can reverberate with mythical content, modern poetry, and historical memory. This is the first level of thinking with cinema that Ghatak attempted. It would take time to disentangle all the discursive threads present in Subarnarekha. Let me point out only a few. The film begins with a title card saying the date is January 26, 1948. The refugee gathering is commemorating the Jallianwala Bagh massacre of 1919 by the British Army. This unusual announcement sets in motion a series of connections. 26 January, 2 years later, will be the Republic Day, the inauguration of the new constitution in India. And on January 30, 4 days later, 1948, Gandhi will be assassinated. In one of the early scenes, we see the news of Gandhi's assassination arriving at a newspaper office. As we cut back to the refugee colony, Haroprasad and Ishwar are shown reading the news. On the transition, on this cut, the soundtrack plays a voice saying, "Hey Ram," the last words Gandhi uttered as he fell to the bullets. Towards the end of the film, just after Sita, Ishwar's sister, kills herself, the same "Hey Ram" returns on the soundtrack. A second thread. Rabindranath Tagore is an abiding presence in Ghatak's universe, in almost all his films. Here, in Subarnarekha, apart from Tagore's song, his allegorical poem, Shishutirtho, is used in the dialogue and the written scrolls that punctuate the film. Tagore wrote the original English version of this long poem, The Child, in 1930 in Germany, at the request of the UFA studios for a screenplay. It was never filmed. He adapted it to the Bengali Shishutirtho 2 years later. It should be noted here that Tagore's inspiration was a passion play he saw in Germany. And the child in question is a Christ-like figure. Towards the end of the film, we find Ishwar and Haroprasad drinking in a bar. This is the third thread. Ishwar and Haroprasad drinking in a bar. We hear Patricia, the theme music of Fellini's La Dolce Vita, playing in the background as the two men discuss the Upanishad. This is followed by a taxi ride through the night. Drunken voices talk about how the present has forgotten the recent past, even as sacred texts in Sanskrit, namely Kathopanishad and Ishopanishad, are mixed with nonsense modern verse. Can we play the taxi ride? Yeah.
Jagrati, Bhagpo, Maran,
Nivolna. Most of the dialogue is heard over passing blurred lights. The technique of separating the voice from the body serves as the second plane of reflection in the film. The director developed a method of construction that made consciousness itself relatively independent of the individual. Unanchoring the voice is a part of that method. A remarkable instance occurs in the middle of the film. Obhiram and Sita go to the Sal forest. This is just before the middle of the film. Obhiram and Sita go to the Sal forest where they express their love for each other for the first time. Such scenes especially demand facial expression and a full rapport between the voice and the body. But we keep watching the two from the back or from an angle where their mouths cannot be seen uttering these words. Can we have the second clip? Aaron? As they turn into whisper, you must have noticed, those of you who are interested in editing, you must have noticed that this is something extraordinary happening here. There's nobody cuts like that. No film school ever teaches you to cut from one shot to another like that. You know? So Adrian Martin is one critic who has written quite eloquently on this, on the editing of this scene. That's the last chapter of his book, Mise-en-Scène and Film Style, I think it's called. As they turn into whisper, their words become one with the murmur of the wind blowing through the sal leaves. The surroundings seem to take over the task of utterance. The whole place seems to whisper with the wind itself. The sweeping pan away from the figure towards the end that you saw, it actually goes up and then sweeps away left to right. That sweeping pan, we also see something similar in the finale of Cloud-Capped Star, makes for a final freeing of affect from the person, releasing, if I may use the expression, an ownerless emotion, as it is sometimes called in Indian philosophy. It is also possible to see this as a distribution of consciousness over space, a principle the director followed from his second film, Ojantrik. The pan makes a purely subjective connection between spaces, between where they were earlier and this location. But a moment's reflection reveals that this subjectivity is not confined to Sita as an individual. It seems to have an autonomy, which I'm trying to see as a premise of thought. The space itself becomes a contemplating instance. In the same year, 1962, Godard's Vivre sa vie opened with Anna Karina, and I think it was André Labarthe, her husband, plays her husband, Paul. So Vivre sa vie opens with Anna Karina and this actor speaking with their backs to the camera. Ghatak could not have seen the film. They were making the two films at the same time. And uses the technique quite differently. But there are more than superficial affinities at work. It's not a kind of going back and forth of influence and impact. It's an affinity. It is usually said that Godard's work took a Brechtian turn from that film, Vivre sa vie. Among other things, the idea of the 12th tableau division was borrowed from Threepenny Opera. In a remarkable short essay on Subarnarekha, written to defend the film against attacks, that was in 1963, Ghatak mentioned Brecht and his Threepenny Opera as an instance of representation without recourse to realist fidelity. These are strange coincidences, but I would like to see this as a set of affinities rather than just accidents. The scrolls of text that appear at intervals in Subarnarekha divide the plot into episodes, that Ghatak likens to the English tradition of chronicle play. I quote from him. "I have tried to lay out Subarnarekha," he writes, "in the mode of the chronicle play. I have tried to indicate that from the opening words, themselves. Written words appear at intervals in conformity with the rules of chronicle narration." This is the essay I just mentioned. It's called On Subarnarekha. It is possible to see this as part of his assimilation of Brecht's idea of the epic theater, his own way of assimilating, re-articulating that. One needs to investigate this aspect of Ghatak's work freshly, as well as his relationship with the moment of the new wave. His cinema looks bafflingly idiosyncratic, difficult to place in any cinematic movement or tradition, but it would be productive to trace its connections with artistic practices of the period as we avoid grouping or the question of influence. Making space for thinking itself seems to be an objective of the orchestration of cinematic elements. One could still ask, what could be a possible object of thought? Making space for thinking itself could be an objective. But then, what could be a possible object of thought? As we arrive at Subarnarekha through the preceding films, it becomes clear that the film invites us to contemplate connections, connections between individual lives, between individuals and historical movements, between nature and human agents. This becomes legible on the third level of contemplation. One, this level is enabled mostly by the structure of coincidences and temporal intervals in the film. Coincidences associated with a debased form of melodrama were a major reason for the adverse criticism that greeted the film. It could not be released for 3 years. It was released very briefly in 1965, had to be withdrawn quickly from the theaters. You know, coincidences were one of the reasons. There are indeed many of them. Abhiram discovering his estranged mother on the local railway platform just before her death, thereby also discovering his low caste origin. Harok Prasad arriving at Ishwar's quarter, Ishwar's friend, arriving at Ishwar's quarter right when the latter was about to hang himself. Obhiram's accidental death. Ishwar turning up at Sita's door as a customer the day she is forced into prostitution, and so on. That these are not lame options to hold the plot together, or that the plot was just a bare structure, quoting Ghatak himself, to explore something else, Ghatak failed to communicate. These points, he failed to communicate. The film seeks to build a form out of coincidences. And let me quote from this essay on Subarnarekha. I quote, "The central event, the brother ending up at the doorstep of his sister in search for paid sex, is such a great coincidence that I thought of using coincidence itself as a form in this film. I have tried to leave clues for the audience about coincidences occurring in the film from the very outset. I have injected connotations in the formal order of coincidences in order to make them pregnant with meanings. Take, for instance, the situation of the brother turning up at his sister's. If you remember the main point of the story, you would agree that whoever the brother might have visited would have been his sister after all. What has been shown here is only a literal expression of that. The purpose here as well is to signify the general in the specific." End quote. We do not associate coincidences with the historical, which is commonly understood as a causal unfolding. Ghatak seems to have another idea of history in view, one whose workings look similar to fate because connections are made in more than one direction in that history. on more than one plane. Connections go back and forth. Things do not evolve rationally, but seem to jump over space and time. Partition as a multiplying process scattered people in such a way that accidental separations, death, chance meetings became the stuff of life. There is now a substantial body of testimonies of the partition. A valuable new material is being added as the Dalit refugees are writing their part of the story. People did go through unpredictable separations and chance unions, as well as deaths and madness. Obhiram's mother in the film is called Kaushalya. Ghatak's familiar practice of using allegorical names for characters takes on bold dimensions here. Rama, the god from Ramayana, is an untouchable Dalit here, Abhiram. But as coincidences become a structure in the film, real-life stories are raised to the level of abstraction. Whoever the brother might have visited, they are caught in a play of forces that has the power to name. Whoever the brother might have visited would be his sister. The power to name. This central encounter is also an echo of young Sita's meeting with the Kali figure, which we talked about. In an essay, also written in 1963, Ghatak writes, "We are all facing that archetypal image. It has been haunting us since primordial times and is stomping about in the world now. It is called hydrogen bomb. It is called strategic air command. It could be called the Gaulle, Adenauer, or something unmentionable." End quote. A disavowal of this essential encounter comes from those who, remember the words from the taxi ride, the first clip you saw? Comes from those who, to quote, haven't seen the atom bomb, haven't seen the war, haven't seen the partition, the riots. They are not named. In fact, there is a mistake in the subtitle here. At one point, it is translated that they haven't seen, but there's no they there. They are not named. The subject is missing in these utterances of Haraprasad. The film attempts representation of a denial here, for which there is no visible agent. It was indeed difficult to accept Subarnarekha. Apart from other things, it was one of the most violent films anyone had seen till date. Sita's death and Ishwar's devastation constitute a moment of eruption that Ghatak puts together with consummate mastery of film craft, forcing us to face the ultimate horror. Can we have the third clip, please? As we try to make sense of this nightmare, we realize there has been an evolving parallel story, the story not to be told. One must think of the episodic punctuation at this point, another device of thinking. After Sita's meeting with the Kali figure comes the first inscription role. Young Sita meets the Kali figure. We see the first inscription roll. It reads like this one. It reads, the first one, "Years pass by after this." As we return to the story, the comic foreman of the factory where Ishwar works, this comic figure, informs Ishwar that the manager has gone mad and has been taken to the city for treatment. The manager in question looks like a vulnerable elderly man with world's suffering etched on his face. The foreman had initially introduced him as someone touched in the head who has withdrawn from the world since his daughter eloped with a man. The next scroll appears after Sita elopes with Abhiram, and it reads, "A few more years pass by." As we return to the story, this time, we see Ishwar crossing path with two villagers. He casts a strange look at them, takes time to come to his senses, and return their greeting. After he leaves, one villager calls him mad. The other says he has the eyes of a murderer. We come to the factory. From this scene, we go to the factory. The same foreman reads out the news of Yuri Gagarin's space travel from the newspaper. He comes and says to Ishwar, "Look, look, the Russians have sent someone called Gagarin to the great void." The newspaper blocks half of the face of this jester, with one bulging eye visible. Ishwar throws the newspaper into the burning furnace. Transitions indicate an alternative set of connections, not just the passage of time in the lives of the dramatis personae. Madness, cosmic travel, the jester as a herald. There is provocation to rethink the function of intervals here. Of one function we could be certain, this logic of transition is meant to prepare us for the violence of Sita's death. The scroll after her death, this one, reads, "Even this night has an end. Days roll into months, months into years." Soon after this, Haroprasad will give a half-philosophical, half-absurd explanation to a journalist trying to find out why Ishwar has been saying to the courts that he was responsible for his sister's death. That Haroprasad is also a jester becomes clearer than ever if you watch this scene. The curious thing is, he uses a line from Tagore's Shishutirtho, that poem we talked about. "Mother, open the door." This is the line. "Mother, open the door." He uses that line to explain what Ishwar was trying to tell the world. He had cited, same Haroprasad, had cited the poem at the moment of Ishwar's attempted suicide. He just appears outside the window in the night. He looks through the window as Ishwar was about to hang himself. Haroprasad says in that scene, and I quote, "What of the night? No answer comes." And I'm taking these lines straight from Tagore. Tagore's English original poem. "What of the night? No answer comes." The last scroll after this will quote the last lines of the poem, Shushitirtha, the same poem. "Wishing victory," quote, "to the newborn, the ever-living." Ishwar goes back to the new home with the orphaned son of Sita. Orphans will be healed, Ghatak seems to have believed, and they will carry the historical burden without the scars of oblivion. Thank you very much.